This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Welcome, folks. It's holidays, if anybody didn't know. Any questions about the meditation instructions or practice more generally?
What is the, what is the kind of general question? What's the purpose of meditation?
My teacher says to get what we really want. It's a great question. And our answer to it will change over time, many times. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, meditation can be good in very circumscribed ways. We could say, not in a negative sense, but very narrow goals. For example, less anxiety, a very worthy goal. And it's likely that meditation can be helpful in that way. But the path begins to take on a different meaning, and our aspirations change over time from wanting to be more comfortable and better adjusted and have more of the things that we like. And it changes to, for me, a need to care for the heart. Actually, and that these practices or practices like this are actually necessary in order for us not to neglect our own heart. And that as we begin to see that the default mode of humanity is pushing on half of the world, pulling the other half towards us. And it's exhausting. And the Buddha was not satisfied with a view of happiness where we just had to scramble to get what we want and avoid what we don't. That even though he had a great deal of success in that scramble, it just wasn't enough. And so we can begin to take up a deeper aspiration to be more and more free of the burden that the pushing and pulling has on the heart. And as we begin to see in new ways, we begin to appreciate the well-being of others in a much more poignant way. And the aspiration of practice becomes also about not causing suffering and being of benefit. So maybe it begins with a narrow focus, and then we wind up, it said, I don't know, we wind up, it said, aspiring for all beings to be free from all suffering. And it might start with, I don't want to have a panic attack today. That's where it starts, and we have to see where it goes. So my advice would be to just be open to what it is. That the people who tend to stay with meditation practice are people who don't have very hardened ideas about what it is, actually, and what they'll get. Does that make sense? So keep some openness about what you're getting into. And I can say that I think maybe always we, in beginning practice, we underestimate how vast the Dharma is. That we actually underestimate the vastness of what we're getting into.
I guess you wouldn't want to, well, I guess holding on to a purpose or something, specific vision would be kind of counterproductive, maybe?
I don't know. There's something very helpful about some general intention or aspiration. You're right, that clinging to an idea of a particular, of like, we come to practice and we sort of want to juice the Dharma, you know? It's like we come and we're just like, I'm going to squeeze out whatever's good for me, you know? And what happens is that whole perspective collapses. That whole way of relating to the Dharma as solution for my problems changes. It does solve our problems, but we relate, it's a different, it takes on a different meaning. So as you practice, you can pay attention to what you're asking for from the Dharma, and perhaps beginning to open up more and more of your life to the light of awareness. You know, that we come in with like, okay, I'm going to look at this part of my life, and awareness just kind of spreads, you know. So let the light be shown on different parts of life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, as far as breathing,
yeah.
You find whatever's comfortable, you know, like with nose, mouth, exhaling out.
Basically, yeah. And if you use the breath as an object of meditation, it's good to pick a location where you'll focus your attention. But some people say belly or chest or mouth, nostrils. But we could do big toe meditation also. I could just ring the bell and say left big toe. Stay with that. Every time the mind wanders from the big toe, bring it back. And so, so the object of object is not so critical, not so critical, and just let the breath be what it is. Yeah.
About the sort of this whole idea of like knowing, like if you had known before teaching that you were constricted, that maybe you wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that this week because, I mean, I'm not the, well, I often can see, you know, I'm in a bad mood or I'm resentful, I'm holding on to something, and I can see it well enough to not, you know, cause damage or, you know, strike out or anything, but I can decide, you know, to remove myself from the situation or to stay silent, but I can't necessarily decide that to be open. So even though I can see it and I can minimize things, I can't, you know, just knowing doesn't open me up.
Yeah. That's great. Great observation. One of the problems with these teachings as we get more familiar in some ways is that we offer the objects of our life, we offer the objects of our mind sometimes most of our attention, but not all of it. And so I'm kind of mindful a lot. You know? Like, there's a partial knowing, but I'm not knowing it at its depth. And it's very likely that there are secondary conclusions that have hardened in the mind about that mood that might be aversive or might be self-congratulatory or might be something. But the mindfulness is knowing the mood and then also beginning to see how the mind has picked up that as an object. Does that make sense? Because behind the knowing of the mood is more attitude. Does that make sense? And the attitude may be, if I just kind of pay attention to this, hopefully things will get better. You know? Or like, sometimes, it's like I have one foot in mindfulness and one foot in delusion. And the practice is to know more and more deeply. And if we can know really deeply, there will be some relief. At least some relief, I think. So your report itself lets me know that you're paying attention in a skillful way and just allow the mindfulness to kind of back up even further. Does that make sense?
Yeah, layers.
Layers. Yeah, exactly. Layers of story. Layers of self.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, one more. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what's involved in working with a meditation teacher? In choosing a teacher,
Well, teachers have different ways of working with students, and some teachers, you know, the Dalai Lama is a teacher. I don't know who his students are. You know, he does have like students. And I, in some ways, consider him a teacher, but then it's often helpful to have somebody who knows your practice, knows your mind, knows how you suffer, and can see with some clarity the way towards more freedom. And so, at some point, I think it's good to find somebody who is you really resonate with, if you're serious about this practice, who teaches retreats, and somebody that you may not initially have a relationship with, but over time, if you're hanging around, you develop a relationship with, who can watch your evolution and just point you in one direction or another, that's helpful for sure. And these kind of classes are good, but it's important also to be in situations of doing some more intensive practice and having some one-on-one contact with teachers in an ongoing way, and on really preferably a senior teacher, you know. And I'm not trying to be dismissive of what's happening here. And I this is there's a lot of great things happening here, but there's value in having personal contact with a teacher who's practiced enough so that they really know the path well, and they know what the diversions are. As my teacher, the spiritual cul-de-sacs, know how we can get trapped and actually are capable of guiding people in a skillful way up to some level of awakening. And that takes a lot of familiarity with the diversity of our minds. Does that answer? Not totally. What?
I just had a few questions as far as interview time with one-on-one time. Is it donation to, you know, how some teachers work, especially the larger, iconic figures, and how? What the protocols are.
Usually for the teachers that people know publicly, the kind of contact you would get would be on retreats, and after developing some relationship, some commitment to practice in that way, that those kinds of teachers, I'm just mostly speculating here, but they're going to want to see some continuity of intention. Because who doesn't want to talk to Jack Kornfield, right? It's like, I want to ask him questions, right? But I'm not gonna just be like, hey, Jack.
Assuming you've worked with the person.
There's some right, and that they want to see that you're trying hard with this, because without that, it doesn't. I don't think it matters. It doesn't matter what they do for you. That it's only in that the genuine, heartfelt effort that they can be of benefit. And the way Shinzen talks about it, he sometimes has these great phrases. He says he's a midwife for enlightenment. That he, of course, doesn't, a midwife, just like a midwife, doesn't create the baby, but he just gives nature half a chance, is how he puts it. And that takes knowing the mind of the yogi. So I normally give a talk, but I'm going to read a story tonight that is a great story. It's a Native American story that I heard in a Dharma talk by Steve Armstrong. So let me log in here. This is might be the first time this has happened up here. So this is a story, and it's about 15 minutes or so. So it's a story that I think an 8-year-old might like, but heavy-duty enlightened Dharma folks like to. And one of the things that's very sweet about this is that it highlights the convergence of all these different paths. That it's just amazing how well this describes the evolution of Dharma, the progression of insight. It's amazing, amazing. And just as we see Christian mystics talk about the world in basically exactly the way that meditators do, the Buddhist types do, this story is just precious in that way. So my encouragement, as was offered in this Dharma talk, is to be able to hear all of these characters as representations of pieces of you. And you can listen to it in whatever way you'd like. But I can say that there are themes, many themes, the themes of being against the stream and renunciation and changing our ways of seeing and compassion and letting go and the fear of spiritual growth, of the guides and freedom, of moving out of our habitual ways of being. Many, many aspects. Very, very cool. So I'm going to just read the story, and I wanted to be able to discuss it, but I don't think we'll have time. So I hope this is good, and we'll see. Once there was a mouse. She was a busy mouse, searching everywhere, touching her whiskers to the grass and looking. She was busy as all mice are, busy with mice things. But once in a while, she would hear an odd sound. She would lift her head, squinting hard to see, her whiskers wiggling in the air, and she would wonder. One day, she felt scurried up to a fellow mouse and asked him, "Do you hear a roaring in your ears?" "No." "No," answered the other mouse, not lifting their nose from the ground. "I hear nothing. I'm busy now. Talk to me later." She asked another mouse the same question, and the mouse looked at her strangely. "Are you foolish in your head? What sound?" And then the other mouse slipped into a hole in a fallen cottonwood tree. The little mouse shrugged her whiskers and busied herself again, determined to forget the whole matter. But there was that roaring again. It was faint, very faint, but it was there. One day she decided to investigate the sound just a little. Leaving the other busy mice, she scurried a little way away and listened again. There it was. Suddenly, someone said hello. "Hello, little sister," the voice said, and Mouse almost jumped right out of her skin. She arched her back and tail and was about to run. "Hello," again said the voice. "It is I, Sister Raccoon." And sure enough, it was. "What are you doing here all by yourself, little sister?" asked the raccoon. The mouse blushed and put her nose almost to the ground. "I hear a roaring in my ears, and I'm investigating it," she answered timidly. "A roaring in your ears?" replied the raccoon. "What you hear, little sister, is the river." "The river?" Mouse asked curiously. "What is a river?" "Walk with me and I'll show you the river," Raccoon said. Little Mouse was terribly afraid, but she was determined to find out once and for all about the roaring. "I can return to my work," she thought. "After this thing is settled, and possibly this thing might aid me in all my busy examining and collecting. And my sisters all said it was nothing. I'll show them. I'll ask Raccoon to return with me and I'll have proof." "All right, Raccoon," said Mouse. "Lead on to the river. I'll walk with you." Little Mouse walked with the raccoon. Her little heart was pounding. The raccoon was taking her up strange paths, and Little Mouse smelled the scent of many things that had gone her way. Many times she became frightened, and she almost turned back. Finally, they came to the river. It was huge and breathtaking. Deep and clear in places and murky in others. little mouse was unable to see across it because it was so great. It roared, sang, cried, and thundered on its course. Little mouse saw great and little pieces of the world carried along on its surface. "It is powerful," little mouse said. "It is a great thing," answered the raccoon. "Let me introduce you to a friend. In a smoother, shallower place, there was a lily pad, bright and green. Sitting upon it was a frog, almost as green as the pad it sat on. The frog's belly was white and stood out clearly. "Hello, little sister," said the frog. "Welcome to the river." "I must leave you now," cut in the raccoon, "but do not fear. Frog will take care of you." And raccoon left. Little mouse approached the water and looked into it. She saw a frightened mouse reflected there. "Who are you?" little mouse asked. "Are you not afraid of being that far out into the great river?" "No," answered the frog. "I'm not afraid. I've been given the gift from birth to live both above and within the river. When Winter Man comes and freezes this medicine, I cannot be seen. But while the Thunderbird flies, I am here. To visit me, one must come when the world is green. I, my sister, am the keeper of the water." "Amazing," little mouse said at last, again fumbling for words. "Would you like to have some medicine power?" the frog asked. "Medicine power? Me?" asked little mouse. "Yes, yes, if it's possible." "Then crouch as low as you can, and then jump as high as you are able. You will have your medicine." Little mouse did as she was instructed. She crouched as low as she could and jumped, and when she did, her eyes saw the sacred mountains. Little mouse could hardly believe her eyes, but there they were. But then she fell back to earth, and she landed in the river. Little mouse became frightened and scrambled back to the bank. She was wet and frightened, nearly to death. "You have tricked me," little mouse screamed at frog. "Wait," said frog. "You are not harmed. Do not let your fear and anger blind you. What did you see?" I saw the sacred mountains." "And you have a new name," frog said. "It is Jumping Mouse." "Thank you. Thank you," Jumping Mouse said, and thanked her again. "I want to return to my people and tell them of this thing that's happened to me." "Go, go then," frog said. Jumping Mouse returned to the world of the mice, but she found disappointment. No one would listen to her, and because she was wet and had no way of explaining it, because there had been no rain, many of the other mice were afraid of her. They believed she had been spat from the mouth of another animal that had tried to eat her, and they all knew that if she had not been food for the one who wanted her, then she must be poison for them too. Jumping Mouse lived again among her people, but she could not forget her vision of the sacred mountains. The memory burned in the mind and heart of Jumping Mouse, and one day she went to the edge of the place of mice and looked out onto the prairie. She looked up for eagles. The sky was full of many spots, each one an eagle, but she was determined to go to the sacred mountains. She gathered all her courage and ran just as fast as she could on the prairie. Her little heart pounded with fear and excitement. She ran until she came to a stand of sage. She was resting, trying to catch her breath, when she saw an old mouse. The patch of sage old mouse lived in was a haven for mice, seeds and many things to be busy with. "Hello," old mouse said. "Welcome." Jumping Mouse was amazed. "Such a place and such a mouse. You are truly a great mouse," Jumping Mouse said, with all the respect she could find. "This is truly a wonderful place, and the eagles can't see you here either." "Yes," said Old Mouse, "and one can see all the beings on the prairie here. "This is marvelous," Jumping Mouse said. "Can you see the river and the great mountains?" "Yes and no," Old Mouse said with conviction. "I know the great river, but I'm afraid the great mountains are only a myth. Forget your passion to see them and stay here with me. There's everything you want here, and it's a good place to be." "How can he say such a thing?" thought Jumping Mouse. "The medicine of the sacred mountains is nothing that one can forget. Thank you very much for the meal you've shared with me, Old Mouse, and for sharing your great home, but I must seek the mountains." "You're a foolish mouse to leave. There is danger on the prairie. Just look up there," Old Mouse said. "See all those spots? They are eagles, and they will catch you." It was hard for Jumping Mouse to leave, but she gathered her determination and ran hard again. The ground was rough, but she arched her tail and ran with all her might. She could feel the shadows of the spots upon her back as she ran. All those spots. Finally, she ran into a stand of choke cherries. Jumping Mouse could hardly believe her eyes. It was cool there and very spacious. There was water, cherries, and seeds to eat, grasses to gather, holes to be explored, and many, many other busy things to do. She was investigating her new domain when she heard very heavy breathing. She quickly investigated the sound and discovered a great mound of hair with black horns. It was Great Buffalo. Jumping Mouse could hardly believe the greatness of the being she saw lying there before her. Such a magnificent being. "Hello, my sister," said Buffalo. "Thank you for visiting me." "Hello, great being," said Jumping Mouse. "Why are you lying here?" "I am sick and I am dying," Buffalo said. "And my medicine has told me that only the eye of a mouse can heal me. But, little sister, there is no such thing as a mouse." Jumping Mouse was shocked. "One of my eyes," she thought. "One of my tiny eyes?" She scurried back into the stand of choke cherries, but the breathing came harder and slower. "She will die," thought Jumping Mouse. "If I don't give her my eye, she is too great a being to let die. She went back to where the buffalo lay and said, "I am mouse, I am a mouse. And you, my sister, are a great being. I cannot let you die. I have two eyes, so you may have one of them." The minute she said it, Jumping Mouse's eye flew out of her head and the buffalo was made whole. The buffalo jumped to her feet, shaking Jumping Mouse's whole world. "Thank you, my little sister," said the buffalo. "I know of your quest for the sacred mountains and your visit to the river. You have given me life so that I may give to other people. I will be your sister forever. Run under my belly and I will take you right to the foot of the sacred mountains, and you need not fear the spots. The eagles cannot see you while you run under me. All they will see is the back of a buffalo. But I am of the prairie, and I will fall if I try to go up the mountains." Little Mouse ran under the buffalo, secure and hidden from the spots, but only with one eye. It was very frightening. The buffalo's great hooves shook the whole world each time she took a step. Finally, they came to a place, and Buffalo stopped. "This is where I must leave you, little sister." "Thank you very much," said Jumping Mouse. "But you know, it was very frightening running under you with only one eye. I was constantly in fear of your great earth-shaking hooves." "Your fear was for nothing," said Buffalo. "For my way of walking is the Sundance way, and I always know where my hooves will fall. I now must return to the prairie, my sister. You can always find me there." Jumping Mouse immediately began to investigate her new surroundings. There were even more things here than other places, busier things, and an abundance of seeds. Then suddenly she ran upon a gray wolf who was sitting there doing absolutely nothing. "Hello, Sister Wolf," Jumping Mouse said. The wolf's ears came alert and her eyes shone. "Wolf! Wolf! Yes, that is what I am. I am a wolf." But then her mind dimmed again, and it was not long before she sat quietly again, completely without memory as to who she was. Each time Jumping Mouse reminded Wolf of who she was, she became excited with the news but would forget again soon. "Such a great being," thought Jumping Mouse, "but she has no memory." Jumping Mouse went to the center of her new place and was quiet. She listened for a very long time to the beating of her heart. Then suddenly she made up her mind. She scurried back to where the wolf was and she said, "Sister Wolf." "Wolf, Wolf," said the wolf. "Please, Sister Wolf," said Jumping Mouse, "please listen to me. I know what will heal you. It is one of my eyes, and I want to give it to you. You are a greater being than I. I am only a mouse. Please take it." When Jumping Mouse stopped speaking, her eye flew out of her head and the wolf was made whole. Tears fell down the cheeks of the wolf, but her little sister could not see them, for now she was blind. "You are a great sister," said the wolf, "for now I have my memory, but now you are blind. I am the guide into the sacred mountains. I will take you there. There is a great medicine lake there, the most beautiful lake in the world. All the world is reflected there. The people, the lodges of the people, and all the beings of the prairies and skies. Please take me there," Jumping Mouse said. The wolf guided her through the pines to the medicine lake. Jumping Mouse drank the water from the lake. The wolf described the beauty to her. "I must leave you here," said Wolf, "for I must return so that I may guide others. But I will remain with you as long as you like." "Thank you, my sister," said Jumping Mouse. "But although I am frightened to be alone, I know you must go so you may show others the way." Jumping Mouse sat there trembling in fear. It was no use running, for she was blind. But she knew an eagle would find her there. She felt a shadow on her back and heard the sound that eagles make. She braced herself for the shock, and the eagle hit. Jumping Mouse went to sleep. Then she woke up. The surprise of being alive was great, but now she could see. Everything was blurry, but the colors were beautiful. "I can see, I can see," said Jumping Mouse over and over again. A blurry shape came towards Jumping Mouse. Jumping Mouse squinted hard, but the shape remained a blur. "Hello, sister," a voice said. "Do you want some medicine?" "Some medicine for me?" asked Jumping Mouse. "Yes, yes." "Then crouch down as low as you can, and jump as high as you can." Jumping Mouse did as she was instructed. She crouched as low as she could and jumped. The wind caught her and carried her higher. "Do not be afraid," the voice called to her. "Hang on to the wind and trust." Jumping Mouse did. She closed her eyes and hung on to the wind, and it carried her higher and higher. Jumping Mouse opened her eyes, and they were clear. And the higher she went, the clearer they became. Jumping Mouse saw her old friend on a lily pad on the beautiful medicine lake. It was Frog. "You have a new name," called the frog. "You are Eagle."
So it's a very moving and poetic
depiction of the path, and take from it what you will. And the teacher who read it, the talk is available online, a really wonderful talk. And you can ask me after how to get to it. So thank you. May all of this be of some benefit for us as a group. And may it point towards the caring deeply about this world, that's where this practice points us. And so may we share some piece of our practice with all that we encounter. Thank you.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.